This podcast is brought to you in part by the estate of Bob Nelson. Bob was a lover of all things San Diego and a longtime supporter of Voice of San Diego and its podcasts. We at Voice of San Diego are honored to have his support during his lifetime and continued support through his estate planning. Are you passionate about resolving conflicts and making positive impact in the world? Then USD's Conflict Management and Resolution Master's Program may be for you. Learn to address conflicts at all levels, from personal disputes to global crises. Join the Kroc School's dedicated community fostering peace and understanding while you acquire practical skills to navigate diverse settings. Apply now and be the change you want to see in the world. Visit sandiego.edu/peace/VOSD. That's sandiego.edu/peace/VOSD.
Welcome to the Voice of San Diego podcast in partnership with News Radio 600 KOGO. I'm Scott Lewis, the CEO and editor-in-chief at Voice of San Diego. I'm glad to be back and joined, as always, by the managing editor, Andrea Lopez Villafaña. What's up, Lopez?
Hey, Lewis.
And reporter Jacob McQuinney is here. What's up, Jacob?
Hey, Scott. So how do you feel? Is it good to be back?
Yes. Thanks. very good. Coming up on the show this week, we'll run through a few updates, like what's going on at community colleges and what's going on with former county supervisor Nathan Fletcher. There are some fascinating filings to talk about in his case. And one of the races I'm most interested in is the race for San Diego City Attorney in 2024. Yeah, prepare to be enthralled by the future of the city's legal division. If haters get their way, it may never be the same. That's all coming up. Stay with us. But first, we have a big goal. We need your help. We're aiming to sign up 100 new Voice members by September 18th. That is less than a week away, just a few days away. So please, if you value this or anything else we do at Voice San Diego, please contribute at voiceofsandiego.org/podpeople, vosd.org/podpeople. That's vosd.org/podpeople. Members get access to events throughout the year, discounts to our big annual summit, PolitiFest. We're excited to see how that's coming together this year. And when you give, you can write a note that our whole team sees. So, Andrea, help me read these. You do the first one. I'll do the second one.
Nice. Okay, so this one's...
No, wait. I'll do the first one. You do the second one.
Oh, okay.
All right. This one's from Stephen Miller. Love the podcast. Looking for a special episode to bring back Sarah, Rye, Maya, Andy, Liam, and even Adrian Florido. Shout out to Rolando Village. Okay, shout out. Who's the, I recognize all those names except for the one in the middle. Andy, is there?
Yeah, I don't know that guy.
That's
R.I.P.
thank you, Stephen. All right, here you go.
Okay, this one's from Christopher Kelly. I am obsessed with the Morning Report and Scott's podcast. Scott's podcast?
Yeah, I think we have to take offense to that one. Christopher, unacceptable.
Christopher with the K.
You see how I engineered so that you had to read that
one? Yeah. See, I just read the first part. It said he's obsessed with the Morning Report.
He's obsessed with the Morning Report and podcast.
So I know, I know, Christopher, thank you. Yes, I do know I am a big presence here, but we can't forget the other contributors.
No one even noticed you were gone.
they did.
I think, Scott, you missed the podcast more than the podcast missed you.
Oh, no, that's not true.
No, that was a little harsh. I'm sorry. Christopher just put a bad taste in my mouth.
I understand. All right, Heather Noss says, the podcast enriches my week. Thank you, Heather.
Okay, Shelby Gomez says, I love the podcast. It's my favorite source for local civic news.
All right, well, join them. Send us a note at vosd.org/podpeople. That's vosd.org/podpeople. Mention the show, and we may thank you as well. Lopez, you just said you got back from Boston, and one of the things you liked was the ability to get around the city on public transit.
Yeah.
Were you able to pay for the transit easily with your phone or whatever?
With my credit card. Actually, they have an app, but I really struggled to understand how to navigate that, so I instantly dropped that And I just went to their pay station, which is, you know, they're all located in their trolley areas or their T. And yeah, super easy. Just select a, you know, trolley pass and you put your credit card up to it and then you just get your little sticker thing.
So we've written and covered how odd the city or the Metropolitan Transit System's Pronto Pass is and how difficult it has been for many people to use to load value on that and then actually spend it so that the trolley fares are collected and they get the revenue that they expected. They have a huge revenue decline because people just don't know or aren't using the system.
Jacob,
you acknowledge that as a regular rider of the trolley, you would never have done it.
I cannot believe that you're calling me out in this aggressive fashion, but yes, I ride the trolley to school from the office and I ride it fairly frequently. And to be honest, I just thought there was like, something magical going on and I you know, you walk in and it just like takes money off your thing, or really what I thought was that you only get charged when you know the trolley cops come on and check if you've paid, and then they scan your thing, and I was like, this is a really inefficient system. I mean, there are a whole lot of times that I'm on this trolley that I don't get charged. And then I talked to Mac,
and our
environment reporter Mackenzie Elmer, and she informed me that I was actually sorely mistaken and had been trolley hopping for years of my life.
I kind of love that, Jacob.
I just paid for the trolley for the first time about a month ago, and it you know, I felt so much better about myself. I could feel like the like years of cardinal sin just kind of washing off of my body, you know.
Well, we do have an update. So we did some reporting. Mackenzie did some reporting about how much people hate the Pronto system and how difficult it was for them to use and how the transit system was suffering pretty significantly because of that. Well, they announced today that the board had voted and the option to pay for transit fare directly with a physical card or smart device enabled with credit cards was considered, and they decided to do it. But they first have to work with, get this, the MTS, California Integrated Travel Project, fare system vendor INIT, credit card gateway provider NMI, and payment processor Chase to discuss the most viable way to introduce open payment methods for riders. So that's the big news. So soon you'll be able to use Apple Pay. Not soon. After they work with all of those.
This sounds like a veritable like blue ribbon committee.
Yeah, they got to go through. That's what it takes. You got to have somebody who processes the payment, who does the payment, and then the credit card company, and then there's just like a whole chain of people that take a little bit off the fare.
Wow, yeah. I take like the tapping for granted.
Yeah.
For everything I use. Yeah. Then. Wow. Yeah.
Well, we can look forward to paying with Apple Pay in the year 2035. Very exciting.
Well, one thing Jacob also knows a lot about is the community college system, and he had an interesting update this week. What was going on with competency-based degrees?
Yeah, so this is a new kind of degree that community colleges are trying out. They created this sort of pilot program in 2021 and solicited essentially applications from community colleges across the state. 8 were accepted, and one of them is right here in our backyard, Southwestern College. They essentially pitched the state on a competency-based degree in automotive technology, which, you know, once you hear about this degree, it's kind of this match made in heaven, right? So basically, competency-based degrees, let me ask you, Scott, would you like to earn a degree without necessarily stepping foot in a classroom once, not doing homework?
I've been thinking for a while, I'm due an honorary degree. Yeah.
On what?
Like an honorary doctorate or something.
On what?
What institution just would you choose? Stuff?
I think like San Diego State or somebody should give it to me by now.
Okay. SDSU, are you paying, if you're paying because, attention, Adela De La Torre?
Because I've learned a lot about the city and I've helped people understand it for a long time now. And I think like that's worth something.
I would support that.
Would you?
That's legit.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, I know they only give it to people who like contribute to the university or otherwise make the world better. And maybe I don't qualify, but I do think I've done enough studying and research of this community to warrant significant recognition.
So I have to.
I can't even say it without looking myself up.
You got so deeply into this that I legitimately thought you were serious.
I am. Was,
he is, but he's afraid to admit how much he is. That was very Andy of me.
It is. It's true. I think you're right.
I'm sorry. Who?
How am I doing, Andy?
R.I.P. okay. Anyway, so
I don't think about him anymore.
Anyway, so
I don't even know who I'm talking about.
Okay, so competency-based degrees. The idea is essentially to create a degree that is more flexible and speaks to kind of the needs of working students, which that's kind of a lot of the student base of community colleges. Working students, they may have families, they may not be right out of high school and have all the time in the world to be sitting in classrooms all day. And so with these kinds of degrees, basically all you need to do is prove that you are competent in all of the sort of fields that encompass an associate degree, right? So there are four general education fields at Southwestern, like language and rationality, natural sciences, that kind of general ed stuff, and then the automotive degree major pathway. And what that essentially looks like is taking a bunch of assessments. Sometimes it may be a written assessment, sometimes it may be an exam. In the case of automotive technology, you walk in there and you have to prove that you can like change oil and realign tires and you know, change transmission fluid. I don't know if any of those things are real car things. I'm not a car guy. But what this means is that for some people, like for example, you know, Scott, he's a big car guy. He's been working on cars for 30 years, mm-hmm. right? He could walk into the class and already pretty much know how to do all this stuff. And so one of the things that these degree programs try to really incorporate is to give people credit for past learning, whether it happened in a classroom or outside of a classroom. And okay. And it's a really interesting concept. And
what does it do though? Why would you want that? Like what, I mean, it'd be cool to say like you got an associate, is that it? It helps you get further opportunities?
It is just an associate degree, right? I mean, one of the things that community colleges have long been saying is that the requirements to work in different fields have slowly shifted and require more education. That was one of the reasons why they really wanted to push the bachelor's degree programs, mm-hmm. right? 10 years ago, you didn't need a bachelor's degree. You could have an associate's degree to work in the audiology field, right? Mm-hmm. But now you do need a bachelor's degree. And the only places that had audiology programs were community colleges for a while. And so this is a similar kind of thing. The kind of degree requirements are higher. And also, again, they're trying to ensure that students that they cater to, maybe older students who are busier or juggling life, have the opportunity to get these degrees in a flexible manner that kind of meets them where they're at. That's one of the things that Randy Beach, the competency-based education co-lead at Southwestern, told me, which is, you know, this is an equity-minded initiative that tries to not mold students into being who the university wants them to be, but to mold education into being what those students need.
On the other hand, I mean, if they're just rubber stamping that person's life gain skill, does it really actually give them an education?
That's a good question. You know, the Southwestern folks have told me that it is a rigorous program, mm-hmm. right? Whereas you can get all of your units and spend all this time in class and pass through college and get your degree with only C's, these assessments, which are flexible and, designed for each of these requirements, you have to pass them with essentially an 80% rate of competency, which is higher than you know, the C requirement for other classes. And so it's
like an institution validating somebody's life skills that they've built up, right? And allowing that validation to maybe help them achieve other things that they want to get.
True, yeah, but there is an educational element, right? So there are online modules that they can go through if they need more experience.
Yeah.
There are teachers there that help them walk through this process. But at the same time, it is, as you said, validating the life experience that these students have. You know, there are a lot of students that, you know, may come into this process and know nothing about automotive technology, while there are others who may be looking for a certification or a degree that helps them further their career. And
or their due honor.
or as in Scott's case, they're due honor. And one of the things that, you know, Brian Palmiter, who is an automotive technology professor at Southwestern, told me is that this flexible program allows teachers to spend more time with students who need more help, while the other students who may already kind of have a leg up are able to move through this process quickly. And so it is a process that allows people to move as quickly or as slowly as they like. It's pretty interesting. And another example, like with the bachelor's degrees of community colleges doing work that I think is super interesting and forward looking. And, you know, I'm biased as someone who went to a community college and really enjoyed that experience.
You can see Jacob's latest edition of The Learning Curve, where that story is, at BOSD.org/learning. BOSD.org/learning. Learning Curve is a twice monthly newsletter about local education. So I remain disoriented by how fast Nathan Fletcher dropped out of public life. And I feel like people aren't really contemplating just how shocking that whole thing was. So dial back. We had Nathan Fletcher, and he was the most prominent Democrat in the region, which made him the most prominent politician in the region. He had just been through the pandemic, where he was the face of the county's response to the pandemic, and the county had the most robust and important government role in the pandemic in San Diego. He was planning to run for state senate. He launched his campaign. He was just everywhere. He was the most coveted endorsement that you could get as a Democratic official running for office. And then he just disappeared. He just vanished. It's so weird, because others we've dealt with, we've seen people in scandals, and they you know, they claw and cling to power for a while. Sometimes they even survive. Kevin Beiser remained on the board of education for San Diego Unified for years after the scandal that they used to demand that he resign. His colleague, all of them, demanded that he resign. He's like, nah. But Fletcher, remember how it went? He says he's gonna seek treatment. He gets a bunch of praise for it. Then we find out that he's being accused by a woman of sexually assaulting and harassing him when he was chairman of MTS and she was a communications specialist there. And then the lawsuit hits and he's gone. And never once, not once, did he say anything or have a press conference or give an interview or do anything more than like a prepared statement from his attorney. And I just think that's fascinating for somebody to be that prominent in local public affairs and then just vanish.
It does seem to demonstrate an impressive level of self-control, which, given everything else we know about Nathan Fletcher, is interesting. And
yeah, like that he's decided, I'm going to just go take care of myself and my family, and I'm just going to leave and never show up again. No, like, Not even a sighting of him going to get his stuff. Nothing. Just like complete vanished. So we've been all waiting to see like what shows up. And the only thing we have are these court filings that occurred. And so a couple weeks ago, we learned that they were having a dispute about Instagram. So dial back. Remember that the scandal is that this woman, Grecia Figueroa, was interacting with Nathan on Instagram. Nathan Fletcher, she says, was pursuing her or sort of stalking her or lurking over her profile. And they began an exchange on Instagram that became what she says were violent or bullying sexual encounters, and where he says were consensual interactions, right? And so the Instagram messages are really important. Now, in her initial complaint, she lists a few of them where he, you know, asks her to come over and does different things to indicate how much he's into her. So he and his attorneys requested or subpoenaed Meta, the umbrella company that owns Instagram, and asked for all of the messages. She and her attorneys filed a response asking to quash that subpoena because they say it's overly broad and would include, you know, other personal data about her that's not fair. Now, he says, well, we would have, we're willing to limit the scope. She says, well, then you should have do a new subpoena. He's like, no, we don't want to do it. It's just this fight about Instagram. And then this week, we got another update. So another filing was put in the system. NBC first noticed it. We got a hold of it too. And it lists out his response. And it was his first real response to the accusations more in detail, right? Basically, he says, well, she praised my looks. She gave me gifts. She initiated contact. You know, she's, and a lot of this would come out if we could get these messages. And
she asked he wear specific things,
yeah,
or something,
yeah,
that was mentioned.
So, but the main thing, and I think a big, probably a majority of the details in this filing were about his demand that she and her attorneys remove references to his wife, Lorena Gonzalez, in the complaint, that she's basically like, you only mentioned my wife to embarrass her and to bring her into this. She had no part of this. Now, remember, Grecia Figueroa argues that she, Lorena Gonzalez, participated in threats against her after all this was filed. Now, I forgot a key part of this. Grecia Figueroa alleges that she was fired without any warning in February, and there was no performance review or performance improvement plan or anything about her performance. She was just fired, and she couldn't help but figure out that the only reason she could possibly be experiencing this is because of this experience she'd been having with Nathan Fletcher.
Right, and her firing coincided with his announcement that he was running for state senate.
Right.
Right.
And so implied in that is that, well, he had her fired. Now, I've never assumed that that had to be the case. Like, the MTS leaders could have easily fired her for, maybe they felt like she was becoming a distraction or a problem, or just maybe they really do have a performance file on her. We've never gotten anything. They did release something saying she was fired for performance purposes or reasons, but we've never seen any evidence to substantiate that, right?
Right.
Now, so in his response, Nathan Fletcher says, well, I could not have had anything to do with her firing because I was just chairman of the board. I had no say over her employment or her pay or her, you know, I couldn't fire her or anything like that, which I think is fine. But again, I don't think there's ever been an implication that, like, he himself fired her. I think that the idea has always been that she, or the accusation has been that she felt compelled to respond to his overtures because he was so powerful in the agency that she was employed at, and that she was suddenly fired for no particular reason. So how does that not add up? And then if there is performance issues, you could also say, like, maybe if the chairman of the agency you work at is sexually assaulting you, it might hurt your performance. Yeah. But all of that said, we've got is that he says, I couldn't have fired her, stop talking about my wife, and she was into me.
That's the biggest takeaway, I would say.
So that's where we're at with that case. Now, the big question remains. There's sort of two big questions that remain. One is, did the most powerful politician in San Diego sexually assault a woman who worked at the agency where he chaired the board? That seems like a big question. I don't know if we'll ever get an answer to that that's definitive. The second big question is, why did MTS fire her? They did an independent investigation. They commissioned one months ago. I don't know what it takes to look into this. All you need to do is look and see, were there documents that led to her performance evaluation getting to the point where they needed to fire her? All you have to do is tell us that. Now, the reason they're not, obviously, is because she's suing And they don't want to, you know, give her anything that would help them lose that case. But I think, and I think it's fair to say, that they owe the public an accounting of why they fired this woman. And that if there are people who fired her for no reason other than whatever entanglement she was in with this man, then that might be something that a public would care about. If they're leading this agency that provides so much service and employs so many people, including so many women. Right. Like, I, you can't just hide behind a lawsuit for months without the accounting that might be due there. And that would mean, I think that there's probably information that the board has now based on this investigation or other things that they could make a determination about whether the leadership deserves to continue doing that.
Yeah. And it's worth pointing out that their initial quote-unquote investigation was going to be their response to the lawsuit.
Right.
And then eventually they
decided. It wasn't until our reporting, who did that?
Shut up. Andrew Keats.
That established that they needed to do something, that they weren't doing an independent investigation. And then they later committed to that. And so we're still waiting to see what that is. But meanwhile, the same people running the agency have been running the agency now for five more months or whatever, and could be rotting the same terrible management style since then, or could be validated that they deserve, that this woman did deserve to get booted. So I would like some clarity, Jacob.
Well, I mean, that's why you are due your honorary doctorate. Honorary doctorate in clarity seeking.
So we also tried to figure out what happened to him at UC San Diego. You asked for some documents on that. All they said is he's no longer employed at UC San Diego as a professor of practice. The professor of practice is that where they let people who don't have traditional doctorates, because of their experience, are allowed to teach, and he is no longer employed there. Mm-hmm. I would guess that if he's not employed there, they didn't have to go through the big process that it would take to fire a teacher or a professor, and so he might have just stepped away.
Yeah, we requested documents about any sort of complaints that occurred, and we did get one back that was that came in around the time that all of this was going down, and it seems to be the woman that spoke to San Diego Vale and NBC around that time. And ultimately, the university responded to that woman's complaint, saying that they'd close the investigation because Nathan Fletcher was no longer employed there. Hmm. And it only would have been an administrative disciplinary investigation. So if he's not employed, there's no administrative discipline to hand out.
There's no reason to figure out what might have happened in the past to your students.
That is certainly a troubling.
It's a very troubling response.
It is, yeah, and it's very surprising.
We're good. He's gone.
Right, like with the same thing. I mean, like this is very different, but you know, in the case of the high school student who alleged that she was raped by San Diego State football players, some of those students weren't even students at San Diego State University anymore.
Yeah.
Right? But is that worth not investigating? I don't know. That's kind of weird. I think that's a weird response.
No, I definitely, I mean, that
the teacher's
is what,
gone, so peace.
It's definitely, it's an interesting response. And I mean, I guess one that makes sense from OPHD's perspective, which is their Office of for the Prevention of Harassment and Discrimination. But at the same time, I think that not only that student, but all students at UCSD and San Diego, the San Diego community at large, deserves to know what happened there.
Right. A student claims to be sexually assaulted or harassed by a professor. The professor's gone, and so, okay, sorry, we can't do anything about it.
And there was an interesting element to her complaint, which she sent to OPHD, which is the office at UCSD that handles these sorts of complaints. She wrote that she had spoken to somebody at the Sexual Assault Resource Center at UCSD about this years earlier, but was unaware that it essentially just offered therapeutic services and did not sort of open investigations into individuals who have allegations of sexual assault against them, which is, I can imagine from her perspective that that's very baffling. She basically emailed saying, I reported this to SARC in 2015 or something like that, and they never opened an investigation. I never heard anything back. Mm-hmm. And so
that's just the wrong door.
Exactly. She went to the right building and knocked on the wrong door, and they didn't help her. They didn't, mm-hmm. they didn't forward that investigation to any, or that complaint to anybody who had the power to open an investigation. So I think regardless of whether or not, you know, UCSD wants to hide behind this could have been an administrative discipline investigation, there should be more clarity there.
Yeah. I mean, again, there's like another comparison to the SDSU thing, right? Mm-hmm. With the dad of the student who had gone to San Diego State Police and had made a report of this assault that occurred on his daughter. And basically, like, because San Diego Police Department was already investigating, it was no longer something that campus police could investigate. But, no. you know, he didn't know that, you know, that him talking to campus police couldn't really do anything, you know, so he kind of felt like, you know, what happened here? The school dropped the ball, but yeah. the school said, well, we were following, you know, the sort of procedure that happens because the complaint was made with the local police first before yeah. our campus police. So.
And, you know, I think it's just another example of these Byzantine procedures that get in mm-hmm. the way of Scott's beloved clarity and honestly, clarity that we all deserve.
Well, I'll be following that and we'll be keeping updates going in the morning report. We're going to take a quick break. Stay with us.
Are you passionate about resolving conflicts and making positive impact in the world? Then USD's Conflict Management and Resolution Master's program may be for you. Learn to address conflicts at all levels, from personal disputes to global crises. Join the Kroc School's dedicated community fostering peace and understanding while you acquire practical skills to navigate diverse settings. Apply now and be the change you want to see in the world. Visit sandiego.edu/peace/VOSD. That's sandiego.edu/peace/VOSD. Join culture creator Ramel Wallace, museum CEO Micah Parzan, philanthropist Erwin Jacobs, and urban agriculturist Diane Moss on Season 2 of Stop and Talk, a podcast about the future of the San Diego region. How can we create a vibrant region that celebrates our cultural richness and economic strength? Find out and hear other San Diego experts on Stop and Talk. Discover Seasons 1 and 2 now at stopandtalkpodcast.com. That's stopandtalkpodcast.com.
So when we were preparing for this, had you guys already known what the city attorney does at the city of San Diego?
Attorney activities, right? they go around, probably, I imagine, a briefcase of some sort, you know?
What, so, like it's hard?
So the San Diego city attorney is elected. It's an elected office, and it serves two roles. So in the city of San Diego, the city attorney provides attorney services to the city. So the city is itself a corporation, and the city attorney's, it's kind of, you know, general counsel, provides lawsuit advice. If somebody threatens it's there. If it goes to court, it's there. It hires attorneys if it doesn't have them in staff. And then it has a whole separate division, a criminal division. And the city of San Diego is the only city, the only part of the San Diego County where it handles its own misdemeanor prosecutions. The district attorney handles all the other prosecutions across the county of San Diego. But within the city of San Diego's boundaries, misdemeanors are handled by the city attorney. And so it has a criminal division to handle those, and it has the civil division to handle all the other advice and litigation and other things it does for the city of San Diego. Now, as an elected official, it's kind of unique. And about almost 20 years ago, a guy running for that office, Mike Aguirre, started to make the case that the person who took this job needed to stop seeing the city as its as that as their client, and to start seeing the public as their client, that they're an elected city attorney, and so the real client is the people
that voted for this person.
Yeah, and thus, and that was a really interesting interpretation and an innovative one in good and bad ways, and caused a lot of controversy because he started to threaten city officials that he would sue them or even prosecute them or otherwise, you know, do things that they didn't want to do. He recognized that as a city attorney, he could do a lot of things. He could control a lot of things. A lot of things needed his signature that he was willing to withhold or otherwise challenge the things that were going through. Bonds that they wanted to issue, different ideas they wanted to go on. He realized that this city attorney's role could be truly independent because it doesn't answer to anybody but the voters. Mm-hmm. Now, the city of San Diego, like I said, is a big corporation and it needs a lawyer. And so people who ran the city were like, ah, we need a lawyer to do lawyer things for us. And we need to be able to talk. Look at how many times we talk to lawyers, right?
Can you imagine? The way we want it done.
Right? Yeah. Like we need to talk to people about to who have our interests in mind so that we can go through these processes. So it caused a lot of controversy. Now, he was thrown out of office, but the next city attorney to come in also kind of acted independently and also frustrated the leadership of the city. And then this city attorney came in, Mara Elliott, and she promised, look, I'm going to be the one who is just fully, you know, the attorney for the city and you're not going to see me much. And then she started acting independently and she recognized the power that the organization had and that as an independent elected official made her more powerful in a different way. And that caused a lot of angst as well. And so once again, another idea has come up to take away the power of the city attorney to provide the advice and civil function of that office. And the ballot measure could go on the ballot that would take away that part of the city attorney's job description and give that to an appointed city attorney and then leave an elected city attorney just to do the misdemeanor prosecutions, which is bananas because they should just, if they're at that point, they should just give the misdemeanor prosecutions to the district attorney and let them handle it all. But they're a little scared of getting rid of the entire city attorney's office in general. So that's happening right now. Now, at the same time, there are two attorneys running for that job. City Attorney Mara Elliott is termed out at the end of next year. And so they want people to, there are people running. Her chief deputy city attorney, Heather Ferbert, is running for that seat. But also running for that seat is Assemblyman Brian Mainshine. Now, he ran in the past, didn't go so well. He's an attorney. He hasn't practiced attorney stuff for a long time, but they did get a ruling or an opinion that said it's cool. You're still an attorney. You can have
just,
that.
Just rusty, right?
Just rusty.
Oh, question. So there's a ballot measure, or they're trying to get...
Yeah.
A measure.
Yeah, so the city council would put the measure on the ballot, yeah.
If that happens, what happens to the race?
Well, it would go at the same time, so it would probably have a future implementation date. So it wouldn't just that person would still take over the office.
But that person would have,
they were just starting to
run. I love the idea of like people stepping into this office and like filling up with the power.
Yeah.
And like
no, it's true. You know? You can see it happen. You can see a person running for city attorney and they're like, hey, how are you? Handing out flyers.
Is that your city attorney?
Or calling a lot. Mike Aguirre used to call a lot and then he disappeared and then he was city attorney. He had this like phalanx of like entourage walking with him and he's got these, you know, shine shoes and he's walking. You can see the ego be fulfilled.
Just
for
like
once.
Imbued with the power of the dark crystal. Right.
I feel like I would be good for
and
that job.
Mara Elliott went through the same thing. I remember her just sort of humbly handing out flyers outside the city attorney's office on her break. And then, you know, she becomes the city attorney. And it just, it does. It you become a different being in public
like
life.
Me. I'm just like a reporter writing stories.
But then you became managing editor.
Managing editor.
Now you got the business the jacket suits. You wear. Yeah.
God, it would just be so funny if, you know, obviously this won't happen, but if that measure passes, and all of a sudden, in the middle of the campaign or something, and these two candidates have to like decide if they want to be the totally broke, powerless city attorney. Now.
I think it would be on the same ballot.
Yeah, I know, but it would be funny. I mean, we can laugh about that possibility.
You win, right? but the voters decide you don't deserve the whole office that you're. Yeah,
you just get dominion over misdemeanors. Like, damn.
So this race is interesting because Mainshine. Remember, he was a Republican, and he was in the assembly. He left the Republican Party, immediately became a Democrat, started caucusing with the Democrats, and then he went through a campaign. The Republicans were like, dude, why'd you do that? and he runs as a Democrat against a Republican challenger. He wins that race. He's feeling good. They love him. They're giving him everything. Mayor Todd Gloria has endorsed him. The county Democratic Party's endorsed him. The labor unions are mostly with him. But then there's Heather Ferbert, who's running as the chief deputy city attorney. Now that, when you put it on the ballot, Mara Elliott ran for city attorney as the chief deputy city attorney, and she was facing two better funded, arguably better known candidates with more endorsements than her, but she won, I think you could say mostly, or at least in a big part, because the title of her right next to her name was chief deputy city attorney. I think voters looked at that and were like, well, she's the chief deputy.
City attorney.
It's her turn.
And she's a city attorney.
Yeah. And so she wins that. Now, so Heather Ferbert doesn't have any of these endorsements, doesn't have anything, but she does have that title. She also has the consultant, it's the same consultant who ran Mara Elliott's campaign, Dan Rottenstrike. And she just got the endorsement a few weeks ago of the Municipal Employees Association. That's the largest union of city employees. And they're into it and pushing it. So I don't think, despite all the heavyweight support he has, that she is at all doesn't have a chance here. So we will see what happens with that.
I'd love a debate of these people.
Oh, we'll do that for sure.
Yeah.
But this week I learned that Mainshine also had a campaign open for Attorney General in 2030. Mainshine for Attorney General in 2030. Now, the Attorney General is the most prominent attorney in the state, does criminal prosecutions, and represents the state on a civil level as well. And
he's got to sort of get his wheels or his bearings again with the attorneyship, and then he's going to go for the Attorney General.
2030. So 2030 is 7 years from now.
Yeah.
I will be well into my 50s.
That's, oh my gosh. Aww.
TikTok has an aging filter now you can put on. It's creepy. But I'll be okay. I look like Tom Hanks.
I look like Tom Hanks.
Honorary doctorate in Tom Hanks.
So 2030, he has this campaign committee open. So I ask him, I'm like, what is that for? So he has two choices. One, he can say, well, I am running for city attorney, but this is where I want to run in the mm-hmm. future. Or he can say, no, I'm not interested in running for that in the future. Then why are you raising money into this campaign? Because he is right now raising money into this campaign for Attorney General in 2030. 7 years
from
now. So I asked him and his staff, his longtime aide, Lance Whitmont, responded that, yeah, he'd be up for running for Attorney General for sure.
The way that's phrased, it makes it think.
Is that how he said it?
It makes it sound like you're the one who came up with the idea. It's like, well, you created the fund.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Like, that's a great idea.
Now that you mention it, I think he would be interested in that.
Good idea. So Jacob had the brilliant idea. Now, I don't know how smart it is. We should set up a campaign, Scott Lewis for mayor in like 2060, and just go through the process and see how it works to make something like that happen.
Mm-hmm.
The future you can actually create a committee and raise money from current sources.
Well, we don't want to expose you to the dark crystal of influence, and so maybe let's find some more small potatoes position. We don't have elected dog catchers here, but something like that.
City attorney?
There you go. And then you have until 2060 to become an attorney.
So watch this race. It's going to be interesting. There are some distinctions in the candidates, obviously different experiences and different future plans as well. So I'll be following that. You can always follow all the things about local politics at VUSD.org/Scott. That's VUSD.org/Scott, where the politics report, which is going to be open for a while. You can only get it if you're a paying member in email, but you can get a taste of it for a little while on the actual website.
Nice. Real good drug dealer tactic, right?
Get a little taste. Yeah. Get them hooked.
Exactly.
And then they'll come back for more.
Thanks for listening to the Voice of San Diego podcast, the most popular public affairs podcast recorded in Greater Little Italy, downtown San Diego. I'm Scott Lewis, CEO and Editor-in-Chief at Voice San Diego. Andrea Lopez-Villafana is Managing Editor. Jacob McQuinney is our Education Reporter. Nate John is our producer. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.